Hi, honey. This is Meg. I just wanted to record a quick podcast because I really liked the comments that you wrote up on Kylie Ruth's post about ordained women.
Okay, sure.
So I'm going to kind of follow the structure of how you responded. And if it's okay, I'd like to make some comments myself in between here and there.
Of course.
So the first thing is, what prompted you to make the comment on Kylie's post?
Well, I was reading the many comments that followed. There were some themes that kept coming up, and I just wanted to have a short list of responses to the various things I thought of while reading those comments.
Okay. So the first thing that you talked about is what kind of answer you'd like to see on women in the priesthood.
Oh, well, yeah, my impression is that people who say, well, we want women to be ordained, assume that they know what the answer is already. And as far as women in the priesthood goes, I want what the Lord wants. But in particular, what I would ask for is for more light and knowledge about it, to ask, well, can you tell us more about women in the priesthood? You know, should women be ordained? I can see three main answers, like say, well, no, the way it is the way I've always wanted it to be and the way it should be. Or you could say, well, I'm glad you asked, because actually women should be ordained and ordain them just like we're ordaining men. Or it could be something like, yes, they should be given some kind of authority or ordained, but it would be still parallel but different from what happens to men. Those are some of the main possible answers. But at any rate, it would be nice to just know more about the topic, since it is bothering a lot of people now. It would be nice to have more information about it.
Okay. Now, at conference, Elder Oaks gave a pretty clear and, I thought, precise talk about the issue of ordination in the priesthood. And from his talk, it seemed that ordaining women to the priesthood is not in the cards.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But the way I heard that talk, he was definitely saying there is a large role for everyone, and women and men in most of the callings aren't so much serving by right of the authority they hold per se, but under the umbrella of the authority of the person who presides. And then, of course, that gets into the concern the folks are having about, well, gee, this means that women can never preside.
Yeah, that is an issue which would be worth asking and finding out more about.
Right, right. Now, when it comes to the term ordain, I think it's interesting to note that when Joseph gave the blessing or revelation to Emma Smith in 1830 in Doctrine and Covenants 25, he was what we would call today saying that she would be set apart for these great callings of leading and preaching and teaching.
Uh-huh.
But he used the word ordain. So that didn't mean she was ordained to the priesthood per se, but she definitely was given power to do things. And I think there's room to see women set apart or, quote, ordained to serve in ways that are currently performed only by men, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, in the next part of your comment, you had said something about decision-making councils.
Oh, yeah, I agree that women, it would be better for to have more women's input in the decision-making councils, whether or not they have priesthood callings. As a small example, one of our former bishops would include the Relief Society president every week in the PEC meeting, even though, rather than just once a month in a ward council, and I think that's a great thing to do.
Right. And again, I think Elder Oaks's talk sets the stage for this, because he said you may have the bishop who is the presiding priesthood authority, but everybody is serving under that bishop. So just because it's called the Priesthood Executive Council or Committee, PEC, whatever it is, mm-hmm. that does not mean that only priesthood should attend that.
Yeah, well, and there's also what, like Elder Ballard said a few years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
The women want to be heard, you know.
Well, he kind of said, you know, if you're having questions about missionaries, maybe you could ask the women. They are their mothers.
Uh-huh.
I think that was what he said. Anyway, I do think that one of the reasons that traditionally the women have not been included in all these meetings is that very often these women had children.
Well, yeah, there is that issue.
And so do you want them to be stuck sitting a whole bunch of meetings instead of tending to certain family concerns that they, in their respective families, may share more than the men in their families.
Well, as a stay-at-home dad, I don't mind, you know, watching the kids while my wife is in meetings.
or something like that.
Yeah.
But I hark back to a time when they made a rule that for sisters serving in the temple, the sisters couldn't serve in the temple if they had children who were younger than 18 at home. And for my mom, she was really upset because she really liked serving in the temple, and she had my brother Sam at home, and so for a couple of years she couldn't be a temple worker until he got old enough, and she was mouthing off about that one time in a room with other women who also were in a similar situation, and these other ladies said, oh, it was such a relief because I felt like I had to do everything, and so... On the one hand, yeah, so for some women, they would have no problem looking at what they've got going on in their life and saying, stop, enough. I have this responsibility, and I need to do this, and you need to just stop asking me to do more. But there are a lot of women who, if they're asked to do or expected to do, they will attempt to do it all, and they and if you have a lot of women hurting themselves because they're trying to do more than is possible, it may be patronizing to put rules in place to prevent that kind of abuse, but I do think there have been good reasons.
Yeah, it's a it's an issue which there are considerations both ways.
Yeah, and I don't know that you can by edict cause women to stop trying to do every good thing that comes down the pike. Anyway, so. You also were talking about the issue where women who need to go in and counsel with the bishop, right now there's no mechanism for them to...
Oh, like say, you know, discussing issues of serious sin how I see merit in the idea of having a woman there present for that too. Now, there's a lot of issues to be resolved around that, but I think that is something we're considering. And I think you mentioned something about that.
So the concern I have about making it, having other women present when a woman is confiding with the bishop is how do you do that so that it doesn't become tantamount to screaming, hello, sexual indiscretion about to be discussed.
There are two women
coming into this room. You know, you could always have somebody there.
Yeah.
But then it would really suck to be whatever woman gets stuck standing by to be able to come in anytime a woman's coming in. And she wouldn't necessarily be someone that an individual woman would feel comfortable with.
And there's various issues. I mean, about like, you know, privacy. I do agree with the need of confession and you know, the bishop's, I guess use the word Episcopal ministry and counseling there and the need for privacy. But there's also a need for support and so on. It's a tricky issue, again. But I think that, you know, I can easily see the church being flexible and allowing certain things about that. But, you know, it is an issue worth considering.
I've been posting in my Faithful Joseph series about what I think was actually happening in Nauvoo when the Relief Society was founded.
Yeah.
There definitely appears to my eye to be precedent where the women of the Relief Society, Emma and her counselors, were reaching out and interviewing and counseling women who had been
seduced,
yeah. So there is historical precedent. Most of us have no clue about that because we just think the Relief Society was this sweet little goody-goody woman's organization for them to meet and get enlightenment and sew shirts.
Yeah.
So one possibility is if a woman has something she feels she needs to discuss, she could perhaps go to the Relief Society president or one of the Relief Society counselors and then handle it that way because there is historical precedent for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anyway, organizational autonomy.
Oh, yeah, I remember there were some complaints about how we're not really autonomous because the bishop can always overrule us, you know. And, well, I thought, no, it doesn't matter who's in there. If it's all women, your leader can always overrule you, you know. So if you have any kind of hierarchical organization, you just can't have full autonomy because you can't grant everybody the ability to do anything they want. There has to be oversight. There has to be the ability to overrule. And of course, that leaves with it the potential for abuse and just managerial stupidity in its many forms. That's not really a gender issue. That's more of, you know, teaching people how to be good leaders and managers.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never made any mistakes as a supervisor and manager. Not. Well, what I would say is, although being required to obey presiding authority isn't a gender issue per se, in my career, as you know, I, for many decades, worked in support of the submarine force. And that means that was a while ago. So even though submarine service is now opening up to women, when I was a young person, they could look at me and say, you're a girl, therefore you have never been on a submarine. And the second part of that was always, you have no idea what you're talking about. So, and I didn't even realize until I started working in a different part of the Navy for a couple of years. I had no idea the amount of questioning and just doubt that I was constantly having to deal with, because most of the people saw me as someone who, by my gender, could not possibly be in a position of knowledge.
Okay. So you're saying that in bishops or other male leaders may have that attitude as well?
It's a possible thing. So when I worked in the other organization where I was not immediately questioned every time I opened my mouth, as a matter of fact, the fact that I had worked for the submarine force, the new folks were like, oh, my goodness, she's smart.
That's good.
So I still had to be subject to the rule of my superiors. And there were times where they called me in and they said, Meg, don't do this and Meg, don't do that. But there was a fundamental level of respect.
Yes.
And I really would like to see some way of explicitly inculcating that respect
so that they do have regular training sessions for bishops and stake presidents, and that could just be another item that they can deal with in those sessions.
So let's talk about equality. What does equality mean?
Well, okay, that's the point I was saying is I think a lot of the comments that people are going past each other because they're thinking of different definitions of equal. And this is similar to what often happens in debates about are Mormons Christian, is that people are talking past each other because they're having different definitions of Christian in mind. So like some people, you know, they say, well, I don't feel unequal or oppressed or so on. And they say, well, you're inherently unequal because you can't do the same things that the men do. But just the main thing of people are working with different definitions. And so they ought to try to acknowledge that is, well, I'm talking about this meaning of equality. And you're talking about that one. Now, you know, and so at least we can agree where we disagree rather than just constantly going back and forth without resolving anything.
Right.
And, you know, it's not to say that there's only one true meaning of equal or of any word. You know, words legitimately have multiple meanings.
Yeah. No, one of the points that I thought of in response to what you said about the definitions, when defenders of the church are saying that men and women are equal, we're talking about the fact that we're equally children, cherished children of God, whether we're men or women. We're also equally servants of God. We, who have been baptized, have pledged ourselves.
Well, this is similar to, like, in the Declaration of Independence, you know, all men are created equal. Well, equal in their rights before the law. And it's not saying that everyone is equally talented or has equal access to opportunities in their life.
Right. So people could say, oh, great, I'm created equal, but I'm living in a place where there's segregation.
and this isn't right, or whatever, yeah.
So you were talking about uniformity, whether or not equality necessarily means uniformity.
Oh, yeah, and for some people it seems like it does, and I don't agree, and I wouldn't want the church to follow that model. I wouldn't want to abandon all gender differences in the church. For one thing, there are real differences between the sexes.
It's been hard to notice, but yes, there are.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I've never liked that strain of feminist thought which says that all differences between the genders are just socially based. I mean, many scientific studies have shown that there are differences between the genders. The males and females are different. Now, in many of these things, it's not black and white, they're, you know, distinct groups. You have two different overlapping bell curves. And so that complicates things because when you have these overlapping groups, you can go either way and say, well, there's a difference implying that there's no overlap, or you could say, no, there's no difference implying that they're exactly the same. And that's not, you know, either simplification is not true.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard that there have been test programs about eliminating Sunday school, and I hope they don't. For one reason, I mentioned this to a different former bishop, you know, because I love studying the scriptures, and I love having the venue where we regularly rotate through and discuss the scriptures all the time. And this bishop said, yeah, and it's also the only meeting where men and women can discuss things together in the same class. And I thought, wow, yeah, that's true. And so I like the fact that we have this meeting in Sunday school where we get to talk about things together. And I also like the fact that we have a block where we, or part of the block where we split apart, where women meet together and the men meet together to discuss things, because women and men will think about and approach things differently, and they relate to each other in different ways. And I think it's valuable to have that space for the men to bond together and the women to bond together, and to have a space where the men and women will interact and mingle. And I really like that aspect of our three meeting block.
And I'll bring up again one of the comments I made in my Being a Mormon Woman post, which is, if they made priesthood an equal thing between men and women, I think that it's likely that they would say, oh, well, we need to not have that gender differentiated block where we have the men with the men and the women with the women. We'll have everybody together so that they can equally serve. And I think that people would not be happy with that outcome. Because I don't hear people. Yeah, I mean, even though you said, hey, by the way, I would hate it if Sunday school disappeared, most people, they don't wax rhapsodic about Sunday school. The thing they love is the chance they have to be with either their Relief Society group or their priesthood quorum, and have that level of friendship. It's a precious thing.
Yeah. Well, another issue that would come up with making things gender neutral, and this is another sticky issue, is when have men and women serving together, overall, that would mean more opportunity for people slipping and having sex with someone they shouldn't.
Yeah, and even if it's only 1 out of 1,000, now you have.
You know, so, and the church leaders really don't want to have any type of thing to encourage that. I read with Crawford Broderick, you know, as the leader, he was with Spencer W. Kimball, and in like a question and answer session, he asked, he wasn't president, he was an apostle then, but he said, why did you have this rule about that we couldn't drive up one male and one female together in a car to the conference? You know, I mean, don't you trust us? And Elder Kimball said, well, do you think we just make these things up? You know, and he says, well, I mean, there have been cases where people have ended up having affairs because of their church callings. You know, and so there's issues both ways. I mean, we don't want to have affairs. No one wants to encourage that. But also, to say we can't, you know, how much does that mean we can't interact together in leadership positions? You know, that's a sticky issue. I wouldn't want to forbid all of that, but also, you know, no one wants to encourage the other either. So.
Yeah. And I've had the experience where it wasn't a church situation, but I was with somebody that I knew was a member of the church.
Yeah.
And it's strangely, how should I say this? There's kind of an erotic feel if you're in the same thing with an opposite gender person when you both know that there is a standard that you would be held to if you were in a church setting. I wasn't expecting that. And it was like, oh, wow, that's an interesting thing to note. So when there's a taboo, and there's usually a taboo for a really good reason, it makes things even a little bit more likely to happen when the taboo is broken.
Yeah.
Which would be an interesting little, from a scientific standpoint, I think we would see more than the statistically expected numbers of infidelities if we migrated this way, just because it would be like, oh my goodness, now I can do something that I used to not be able to do.
Yeah.
Moving forward into the nature of discussion. You were saying one thing that distresses me about the ordained women conversations is the level of discourse. And, of course, you're not necessarily talking about ordained women themselves.
Oh, well, two things. I mean, like, I think I read someone saying, well, you know, there's this. Never read the comments. Online especially. the level of discourse in the comments section to anything in the newspaper or something like that is really low. Now, you can understand, there's one post I read, which says, I'm struggling with this, but I'm honestly angry about these people who are holding up the church before the world for terms of ridicule. I love the church and the gospel. It means so much to me, and it just really angers me. So I thought this woman was being very forthright in acknowledging the anger that she was feeling, and she wasn't venting her anger directly. She was just saying that this is why she felt angry. And so I can understand why some people do that, but, there's often just a lot of judgmentalism or just assuming that the people who disagree with you are stupid or wicked, it dismays me. But on the other hand, it also pleases me a lot when I see people taking time to try to understand each other and to respond to each other respectfully. And so when I see that happen, it is also very gratifying.
Yeah.
I also had another thing about discourse. If you look in the secular context, of the USA, I find the standard of having debate and discussion and finally reaching agreement, which is what democracy is supposed to entail, it's really actually a high standard, which is hard to meet, because historically, you can see that human nature often is if you want to bludgeon or force your way on others. If you read some of the earlier debates or things going on politically, the things people would say about each other were just, wow. It's just amazing how vitriolic they could be.
Yeah.
And also, the yellow journalism was just at times rampant. And, there's still some of that going on, but it's a lot worse then. And today, a lot of things that happen are, seem like people aren't trying to persuade each other. They're just trying to bully their way. If they want something, they'll try to force a legislation for it. And if that doesn't work, then they'll boycott people who are disagreeing with them, or they'll try to harass them and intimidate them rather than trying to persuade.
Yes, it seems that discourse is more polarized now, and we've certainly seen that in Congress. An interesting insight to that, I had a friend, and because I worked for the government, we really cared about that, particularly when they went and furloughed us all there for a while. My friend pointed out that things became intractable when they got rid of the pork, when they got rid of the plus-ups. So it used to be that folks in Congress, for example, they had a reason for being nice to each other. They had a reason for cutting deals because they had something that they could possibly push through that would bring money to their district.
Oh, okay.
And when that went away, there was no longer any reason to cooperate. So subtle little things that you don't think about can make a huge difference.
Well, I also think one of the biggest problems politically is the fact that we need to change congressional redistricting, because Congress, it's become a very refined science now of making districts that are safe. And so you don't need to appeal to the general public. You just need to appeal to the hardcore of your party. And I think that's a big reason why things are so polarized, because the system is not set up now so that moderates will get into office. It's more the hardliners that will get into office.
Right, on both sides. There's also just, if you look at the number of folks in the public discourse in our country, for example, the number who are lawyers, for example, in China, once they came over and they said, it's really hard to communicate. And they said, you mean the difference between Chinese and English? And the response was, no, you are led by lawyers and we're led by engineers. So another aha moment I had about the whole thing is when I learned that Kate Kelly, who stood up the Ordained Women movement, is an attorney working for International Women's Rights. So her fundamental worldview from that professional experience leads her to, one, she's bought into President Carter's assertion that if women aren't given access to all levels of the religiosity of their time and place, then they will necessarily be treated unequal. And two, as a lawyer, the way they get things done is through antagonistic confrontation. So it's not that I agree with what she's done per se, but at least now I was like, now I understand why she felt this was an appropriate venue and an appropriate method to effect the change that she believes needs to happen.
There's such a disconnect when people try to use political methods to try to affect change in the church. I think, don't you understand how the church works? doctrinally and ecclesiastically, this goes against several things. I mean, first, our belief in modern revelation and that God will reveal what it is, and we can't just force our will on the church. It goes back to my first comment about saying that, you know, some people think they know what the answer is already.
Yeah.
But then also, the method is, you know, in the Book of Mormon, when Christ appears to the Nephites, practically the first thing he says is, stop having disputations about doctrine. You know, Mormons are, you know, they don't like having arguments about things. You know.
Some of us do, but we're not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's human nature. I mean, but it says, but by disputation, it doesn't mean like disagreements and trying to work things out. I think it just means disputations in a negative sense, and
yeah.
Which is the political method seems to do that. And there's also, you know, trying to reach, like I said, the method is, you know, to use your authority with patience, long suffering, kindness, persuasion, and all that. And the political method rarely yields that.
Yeah.
And that's the doctrinal level. And then there's the practical level, is that it really doesn't work. You know, if you try to politic, you know, first you'll make the leaders dig in their heels because they don't want to encourage that kind of behavior. That's not what they want. And so if you're trying to persuade us by politicking, it's not going to be rewarded. And then also it creates the resentment in the members kind of that we've mentioned before. Is that,
yeah.
You know, it doesn't. You don't get the sympathy of the people you're trying to win if you're using that method.
Right.
Now, I will say, and this is one of my most important points here, is that, I mean, for some time, it hasn't been a big issue on my mind, but I think that one of the biggest things I would like to see in the church is a formally instituted procedure in which people could raise their concerns to the leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And there really isn't a mechanism to do that. And I think that's why sometimes when people get agitated enough, then they revert to the political model of, you know, trying to campaign or, you know, picket or demonstrate for all these things. And I think, you know, if there were, you know, so that actually, you know, about the whole issue that disordained women with women, so that's, it brings this question again to my mind. What I would really like to see is the church leadership pleading with the Lord, saying, what's the best way that we can have members raise their concerns with the leadership so that they feel like they're being heard? And they feel like they're being heard, rather than seem like they need to go around the ecclesiastical system and try to politic it.
Right, right. And I had asked when we first were talking about this, I said, well, do you have a suggestion on how we might be able to do this?
Well, no, I didn't really. But thinking about it, there have been a few times in my life when I've been at a meeting and, like, one of the apostles said, okay, let me open this up for questions and answers.
Yes.
And that's been very... once it wasn't so successful, since it seemed more like it was approached like a question answer, like, what are things you'd like to know or understand?
Yeah.
But another time, I thought it was wonderful because the person was seeking feedback.
Right.
And so, and he was, you know, writing notes to take back home with. And so that was one venue in which feedback was sought.
Yeah. Although I'd say that's kind of small feedback. I'm grateful, and I think I was at that meeting. I was so grateful that happened. But when you asked that question, I thought, wait a second. When you were saying, how could we possibly make it so that the concerns and I would say more than the concerns and the triumphs of the voice of the members is heard.
Yeah, and that's
without it just being the loudmouth like us who would blog about it.
I mean, that works on several fronts, too. Like, say, what's a good way, Christ-like, yet ecclesiastical and systematic way of maybe raising concerns about ecclesiastical abuse?
Well, I wouldn't even so much focus on the ecclesiastical abuse. Now,
that's just one aspect of it.
Yeah, we have a case study where the various folks, Levina Fielding Anderson and others, formed their nonprofit Mormon Alliance because they said, hey, it appears that there are some instances where people are doing some really skivy things, and we think it would be useful to stand up this situation so if people have concerns, they can come forward, et cetera. Now, the challenge, I think, from the church's standpoint about the Mormon Alliance is that they had this external entity that was setting themselves up in the role of the people who were, quote-unquote, finding truth. I remember this is when we were dating, and you handed me – you were sharing all kinds of things to read, and my impression is when you share me something to read, you're trying to share your worldview with me. And I enjoyed it, you know, Arthurian fiction or, you know, other things like this. So you handed me this issue of Dialogue that had a bunch of the Mormon Alliance folks writing
in it. Oh, I'm not sure it was Mormon Alliance. But
no,
anyway,
it was.
There were some articles that really bothered me, and I wanted to get your feedback on it.
Yeah,
but I didn't want to prejudice you, so didn't tell you, well, this really bothers me. Can you, you know.
So you just handed me this thing with no introduction, and as I read it, it really bothered me. And I thought I was going to have to stop dating you if this was stuff that you were sympathetic to. So then when I came back, I think the conversation went, you know, this, I was really bothered by some of the articles I read in this. And not bothered like it was tearing down my testimony. I was disagreeing with the method and manner of what they were doing. And then you blithely said, oh, yeah, it bothered me too. And I was so mad. You know, I thought I was going to have to break up with a man that I really liked. And all you had to do is say, you know, I'd be interested in your opinion. I mean, there's so many ways you could have just at least prepared me for the possibility that you weren't in favor of this stuff.
Yes.
Anyway. So getting back to how would it be possible for leaders at all levels to get more feedback from their member?
Well, there's a variety. I mean, most of these general authorities have been in secular leadership positions too, and they have a variety of, you know, from education, business, government. You know, I mean, a lot of things, and so I'm sure they could take their experience and then, you know, pray to the Lord and get guidance. I mean, I'm sure that they could figure out a lot of possibilities there.
And there's something that's already been figured out by Stephen Covey. So towards the end of his life, he wrote the book The Eighth Habit, which is talking about the power of trust. And when you actually have this environment of trust, you can be so powerful. Of course, he was writing it for corporate businesses.
Yeah.
But
I figured out their approach to that question, too. I mean, there have been a variety of approaches.
Can I just talk more about this one?
Sure.
Because I think it's particularly powerful.
Okay.
Having studied it. So in his book, The Eighth Habit, one of the things you see mentioned, but it's not heavily politicked in there, is the idea of an execution quotient. And since I'm a manager at my work, I looked into that, and I really, really loved it. And the way that they would deploy this thing is that on a quarterly basis, you'd say, hey, by the way, you know, fill out this survey. And reading the questions, it's the kind of survey you would want to fill out. Because it was openly saying, you know, are there things you would like to have improved? Are there things that are going really well? And it was a short survey. And what they had done before they rolled this out and published the book is they had benchmarked it on a bunch of cutting-edge leading businesses so that for a business, at least, you could look and say, wow, I'm at this level compared to businesses that are really well, and you could look back at your own past and see how things are shifting and changing, giving you an ability to start responding before big issues started popping up amongst your members, constituents, whatever. So we already have the LDS login that is used for gaining access to the directories, for going in and doing family history work, etc. So if you're a member and have access to a computer, which is being stressed more and more and more because of the family history aspect, it would be easy to say we as the leaders, as the members at all levels, we want to know how we are serving you. We want to know what you like. We want to know what you dislike.
When you mentioned –
And we'd like to know whether or not you're talking to us.
Yeah.
That's another metric.
When you were mentioning Covey thing, it reminded me once I hearing about some business, they had a simple format like for their suggestion box and like start, stop, and keep. You know, like,
yes.
Like stop doing this or start doing this, please, or keep doing this. It's good, you know.
Yeah. And so I'm not saying that they should go and pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Franklin Covey people to adopt that model,
I wasn't thinking of any particular method, but I'm sure that, you know, they just say it'd be nice to have. Now, we believe in a Church of Revelation, and it's a top-down structure that the lines of authority come from. But there also needs to be a bottom-up structure to it, because they are ministering to the members, and it's hard to minister to them if you don't understand what's going on with them.
Right.
You know.
And if you're all male, then you're fundamentally going to have a blind spot towards the concerns that the female part of the congregation has.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I love going back to the history. I mean, the whole LDS movement, even if you don't believe in it, you have to acknowledge that it all started because of one boy's question. And mm-hmm.
And most of the revelations have come from questions.
For example, it was a woman who had a deep burning question about her son being damned, she believed, that brought about the revelation about the ordinances on behalf of the dead. Sister Nyman.
And I understand the question that led to the word of wisdom, from what I've heard.
yes.
Was that women were saying, it's disgusting that the men spit this tobacco and don't always get it in the spittoon. Could you ask the Lord about that? And and the men said, well, yeah, could you all ask about the tea that the women are drinking all the time? You know, and you know, anyway, so questions often lead to good revelations.
And the thing I love about the word of wisdom is I think when we ask questions, it's not even that we're getting the answer that was sought.
Yeah.
Because I look at the word of wisdom and being as aware as I am of the various environmental challenges. Of course, now everybody's like, oh, global climate change. I guess it is happening. Look at all these hundreds of scientists that are saying it's a problem. When I look at what was said in the word of wisdom, I see a God who said, Joseph, you're dealing with tobacco-stained floors, but I see a future where the world will be in danger. And so I'm going to give you some guidelines as to how we can live so that that's not a problem. And so I'm just fascinated. Of course, you know, most Mormons would say, what do you mean? Oh, I don't want to talk about environmental stuff. But I love that God can use our questions to pour down knowledge beyond that which we're seeking. And I think that if we allow the entire membership to voice these active ministerial joys and concerns, will just increase the power of the church.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why I like the idea that I put forward. But I am perfectly happy with however they do it. And I do know the lovely thing about the fact that Mormon leaders tend to be people who have administrative experience in their secular life is they do know how to do this. So I look forward to seeing how they come through it. Anyway, good. So I actually really like being able to talk with you about stuff like that. And
I
think that it's kind of fun now that I know how to post podcasts with my Millennial Star stuff. I would kind of like to have discussions every once in a while with you on stuff. So
yeah, I'd enjoy it.
So we'll see what topic next piques our interest.
Okay.
And go from there. Well, I love you, darling.
Love you too.
We'll talk to you later. Okay. Bye.
Bye.